are listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the role of nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. That's on the radio dial. And if you're listening online, that's because you're streaming. And we are streaming live at CITR.ca. And of course, the third option via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. So if you are listening by podcast, welcome to the show. It could be a Thursday, it could be a Sunday, wherever you're listening. But right now, right here, it's Friday at 8 a.m. here on CITR. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the show. We have a great one today. It is going to be a very interesting and hopefully intriguing show. And let's not forget the weekend is here. After all, it is Friday. Bright, sunny, warm. It's very nice out. But it is, as we get closer to summer, well, I guess we are at summer now, but it is allergy season. It is the season of sneezing. Wow, how do I live with myself? Anyway, if you're like me and you have allergies, well, welcome to the club. It is a bit frustrating, but fortunately, once that allergy medicine kicks in, I will be good as rain. You may actually be able to tell that I sound a little bit congested, and again, that is the allergies talking, not me. So I do apologize if I'm a little bit nasally, but whatever. I'm sure you're used to it by now. Anyway, fantastic show today on The Sector. This is episode 45. Today we're going to be talking a bit about the nonprofit sector. I know that last week I mentioned how I wanted to get nitty-gritty, really deep into a particular topic related to working in the nonprofit field. And quite appropriately, we're going to be diving into being an employee in the nonprofit world. What does that mean? What does that entail? And how is it different from working in the for-profit sector? You've probably heard me and others like me talk about the fact that it takes a different kind of person to be happy and satisfied in the nonprofit world. We've kind of touched base on this before in previous episodes. So today we'll kind of examine that claim and talk a bit about what you can expect as a nonprofit employee and ultimately what you, the public, people who don't necessarily work in the nonprofit sector, what you should expect from a nonprofit employee. And given that I'm also a nonprofit employee, I look forward to some feedback. Hopefully people out there resonate with what I'm saying. And if not, you know, let me know why. It'd be really interesting to hear your perspectives on that. Additionally, I also teased last week, I wanted to get into the question of hate speech, whether or not criticism of, say, a nation could be construed as hate speech. And this is something that was making the news rounds a couple weeks ago. We didn't get a chance to touch base on this, so we'll talk about this on the show today. There's also some interesting news going around politically wise, suggesting that our next political election may be setting a lot of historic trends, including could we be on the verge of another NDP orange wave? We will talk a bit about that later on in the show as well. And then I also wanted to get into our third, I guess you could say, big talking point, and that is sports. Yes, it is sports talk today on The Sector. Specifically, the World Cup of Soccer has been in the news quite a bit, actually. Perhaps you've heard about the issues going on with the FIFA World Cup being planned for Qatar, as well as actually just really recently, the fact that several FIFA officials have been arrested on corruption charges. So we'll touch base on that as well. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We'll return after these important messages here on CITR.
Tune in every other Thursday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. with your host, Zahair, for The Social Focus, an interview-based show about how students, past and present, have come up with creative ways to overcome social challenges in the community. Each episode will invite individuals to share their stories of success and failure, along with actionable advice on how to start an innovative initiative that serves the community. Hear from UBC students, alumni, and others involved in the community.
As is Dan from Graymaker.
This is Bossa the What.
Howdy, folks. We're the Bitterweed Draw.
This is Zach from Black Breath.
Hi, this is Artie from Broken Bones.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark.
I'm Water Crime Guide.
This is Dan Mangan.
Hey, this is David Pepke from Denmark.
This is Dylan Ozick from Slingshot.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric Six.
Hi, everybody. This is Fred Penner on the Radio Waves.
This is Brett Schneider.
This is Colin from GBH.
Hi, this is the Gearing Up Inventors.
Hi, this is Ben Ditto from The Gossip.
Hi, this is Brian from Hellshock.
This is Scruffmouth the Scribe.
I'm Shani from Inepsy.
This is Sab Gray from Iron Cross.
Hey, we're J plus J plus J.
This is Jack Mercer from Jack Mercer and the Whiskey Bandits.
It's James Wood, half of Mega Bear.
This is Jeron Paxton, American musicianer.
This is Swami Bill and the Shameless Weed Hounds from New Orleans, Louisiana, east of the Mississippi.
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana.
This is Jesse Laborde.
I'm Peter Mansbridge.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, also on the web, CITR.ca, in UBC, University of British Columbia, in Vancouver, Canada. Have our people contact your people, won't you?
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. Boy, that last PSA just kept going, didn't it? Well, anyway, back on the show. So last week I talked a bit about the notion of hate crime or hate speech and whether or not it would be hate speech and thus a hate crime to criticize a country like Israel. Now, I'm sure that you can assume that when we're talking about Israel, the conversation gets a bit controversial. Now, I can't imagine why. Now, this news story was spurred on by the Harper government signaling its intention to use hate crime laws against Canadian advocacy groups that encourage boycotts of Israel. Once again, the federal government of Canada is sort of reaching out through the long arm of the law to prevent advocacy groups from doing advocacy. That is, well, never thought you'd hear that in Canada. Anyway, now, obviously, there's a couple of factors here that I think we should, at the very least, touch on. Number one, the whole legitimacy of hate speech in general, I think, is a conversation to be had for another day. In fact, I seem to recall, if not on The Sector, then certainly on Radio Free Thinker, I have discussed this before. So maybe give a search of our old archives, see if that comes up with anything. I think that we've covered that pretty thoroughly. Now, the point being, of course, is that if the government is saying, okay, we have a zero tolerance policy for criticism against Israel, that's sort of stage one of this eyebrow-raising point. Now, one could argue that hate speech laws prevent hate speech. Duh. They're being used to prevent racist people from saying, you know, bigoted and horrible things, and that is the point of the law. One could argue that. I think that intelligent people could also argue that hate speech laws infringe on free speech and that they are at such odds that it's kind of, a mental gymnastics that you have to go through to sort of legitimize how one can exist with the other. And again, like, this is a conversation that we've had before in the past. The, I think, interesting point, of course, is that we should all acknowledge is that certainly some people who criticize Israel probably do so out of a racist point of view. They are coming at this from a kind of bigoted, racist, or really hateful point of view. And I think all of us would agree, every progressive out there would say, that if you're doing that, then by all means, let's use hate speech laws, because obviously they're not adding anything to a kind of intellectual conversation. They're just talking to hear their own voice. But I think a lot of people would agree that there actually is a lot of legitimate criticism that you could label at Israel. I mean, certainly you could label at Israel. You could create a whole load of intellectually honest criticism directed towards any nation, China, France, Germany, Russia, just because there happens to be a slight racial undertow to the national identity of that place, shouldn't make it immune from criticism. I mean, if it did, then any kind of criticism of China would also be construed as a racial attack. And I don't think, well, hardly anybody who does that intends it to come across as a racial attack. So again, if we take that as face value and that we're going to assume that for this reasonable discussion, then we also have to look at the question as to why. Why is the government of Canada essentially relying on sort of an intimidating tactic as any criticism of Israel will be construed as a hate crime? Well, what are they looking to defend about Israel? Well, many of the organizations that are taking part in boycotts or other forms of civil protest are doing so at the request or in partnership or with some kind of combination with Palestinian non-governmental organizations, other nonprofits, other advocacy organizations, taking part in international efforts to get Palestine recognized as a sovereign state and as well as to counter Israel's expansion into the area. Now, so you might ask, okay, well, what is the connection between that and the Conservative Party? Is it a relationship to natural resources? Is Israel's current government friendly for the export of valuable resources? Yes, possibly. Is it the connotation of Palestine with terrorism? Yes, possibly. Is it a combination of old-fashioned racism of, you know, white people against brown people? Yes, maybe. So there's a lot of different factors that go into why the government is basically saying you cannot criticize Israel in any way, shape, or form. Now, I should point out that it's not just the conservatives here in Canada that have aligned themselves with this very extreme view of criticism of Israel. In fact, the Liberals and NDP have sort of alongside the conservatives aligned themselves with this notion. And that's unfortunate. The idea that it's being described as, quote, the new face of anti-Semitism, which was actually taken from a document by John Baird, Canada's then foreign affairs minister, that was meant for Israeli authorities in Jerusalem. Now, I mean, again, that's a very concerning way to describe this sort of thing. And it's also, I think, rather insidious in the fact that these efforts, these boycotts and this sort of international awareness raising that Palestinian groups are organizing have actually been way more successful for their advocacy efforts and their goals, long-term goals, than armed conflict has been. And that's not surprising, of course, is it? When you reach out to people with an olive branch, with an appeal to human dignity and human rights, that's going to have a lot more impact than people with guns and whatnot. So the fact that that's making a lot of headway, especially in Europe, has really kind of turned the tide. And I think a lot of areas are digging their heels in, Canada being one of them. Now, this, of course, I think actually raises a rather offensive question, is that the Canadian government officials don't understand what anti-Semitism is. And it's sort of, I think, insulting that they're using it as a shield to prevent legitimate criticism of Israel from happening. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, it kind of feels to me like it's like those claims about reverse racism or something, that they're trying to like hold up this banner and say that we're open-minded and we're the ones who are on the right side of history, and you people, the people who are, you know, criticizing Israel, you nasty, nasty people, you are the ones who are anti-Semitic and you're evil. I think it's a very insulting and patronizing gesture from the government. And again, all corners of the government as well. One could also wonder how on earth something like this could hold up in a court of law and how this could be considered constitutional when boycotts, civil disobedience are protected under the Constitution. Well, the government hasn't exactly been very clear on that. In fact, they've been sort of anti-clear. They've basically been saying that Canada has one of the most comprehensive sets of laws on hate crimes anywhere in the world, and that they will not tolerate hate propaganda, which, again, it sounds to me, and I think it sounds to a lot of critics, that this is more about intimidation. This is more about censorship than it has anything to do with, you know, creating an intellectual conversation around diplomatic relations. In fact, it seems like they're trying to shut down intelligent conversation about diplomatic relations and the, you know, complicated nature of Israel and Palestine. So what do you all think, listeners? Is this a question of censorship, or is it there is a legitimate case here that these organizations are using hate speech and hate-motivated propaganda, as it was put. What are your thoughts? Let us know. Email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, we are also on Twitter, at Ethan Clow, that's me, and at Sector Podcast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and at our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And we have our show notes, as well as podcast, there for you to download. Okay, well, moving on to our next subject. Sports talk radio here on The Sector. Now, we've actually kind of talked about this a bit in the past. We discussed when the Brazilian World Cup was going on, the enormous costs associated with building these stadiums and these venues, which actually, and I was just reading this a couple days ago, largely have gone completely empty since the World Cup. These stadiums, some of which cost billions upon billions of dollars, constructed in small cities, towns, areas where there were no professional soccer teams to begin with, are now sitting empty. They're being used as rent-outs for kids' birthdays, bus depots. I mean, all you can imagine the amount of just waste that went into it, not utilizing existing resources but building new ones. Now it looks like that process is happening again, but with a far darker connotation going on right now in Qatar. And, oh, wait, Actually, apparently it's pronounced Qatar, like cutter, Qatar. Okay, well, whatever. I'm probably not saying that right anyway. I don't think there's an English language equivalent for that sound. But, okay, Qatar. Now, the claims going on in Qatar are that not only is this a sort of boondoggle of Olympic proportions, that's a dig at the Russian Olympics, which cost, I don't know, 80 billion, trillion, gazillion dollars, but this is actually going kind of beyond that. Instead of just being a massive waste of money or sort of a corrupt waste of money in a lot of ways, lining the pocketbooks of, you know, oligarchs and businessmen and shoddy construction, this is actually a human rights issue, as the state of human rights in Qatar is kind of abysmal to begin with, that a lot of people are being worked to death. There are really unsafe conditions going on. There really is no way for workers to be compensated or protected or looked after in the event something does go wrong. And basically saying that, I mean, this is essentially kind of like a police state of operations, building these stadiums. And, you know, if you complain or if you, you know, ask for, you know, basic human rights and freedoms, you get thrown in jail or worse. So there's a lot of concern that these big sporting events like the Olympics, like the World Cup, are only going to go to countries that have this kind of tyrannical power. Because if you try to land them in, you know, America or Canada or Britain or whatever, the public population will not support it. They will not support a hike in their taxes to pay for a big, you know, 2-week party. So that's one side of this now. And these concerns have been raised time and again. There's actually calls to, you know, boycott some of the sponsors like Coca-Cola. You know, I don't see the federal government coming in and saying, oh, that's hate speech against Coca-Cola. So I don't know. What does that tell you? But in addition, just recently in the last couple of days, some of FIFA's top brass has been arrested and charged with corruption. These charges relate to what we can assume to be bribery and other corruption, which allowed the World Cup to be awarded to Qatar in the first place. After all, we're talking about a very small nation with a small soccer culture, if at all, and incredibly hot temperatures. In fact, so hot that many have questioned whether or not soccer is even actually possible to be played at that temperature. Additionally, it's a country with a very big migrant worker population that is dying by the truckloads. So again, Qatar imports a lot of migrant workers from other countries, And it's a very unsafe place to work, as the aforementioned human rights abuses. In addition, though, workers die from the heat. They die from lack of resources, lack of structure from the organizations in Qatar. Now that the World Cup is working there, the concern is that a lot of additional deaths, unrelated to sort of the background migrant worker death in Qatar, is going to increase. Now, the arrests, of course, have come just recently when the U.S. FBI, IRS, and officials in the Justice Department et al. Arrested a number of individuals in America related to racketeering and bribery for corruption charges with the World Cup and FIFA, dealing out the World Cup. Additionally, Swiss law enforcement was working simultaneously with American authorities, and they arrested a number of high-ranking FIFA officials in Zurich, where they will be extradited to the U.S. So, I mean, this is a pretty remarkable and dramatic takedown, especially considering that FIFA has always kind of been considered untouchable, and in fact, that they could just kind of get away with rampant corruption, and there was really no way for them to be stopped in any meaningful sense. And that's, not all that unusual with, really powerful sporting bodies that operate internationally. I think like organizations like the NFL in America have kind of actually been seeing a bit of this as well, especially around the issues related to domestic abuse and cheating and whatnot. So it's a very interesting development. One that I think we've touched base on before, this notion of the Olympics and these large international sporting events, the cost associated with them, not just the monetary cost, but the human element that goes into it, clearly is starting to outweigh the purported benefit of these events. And it does raise the interesting question of, for how long will people, really reasonably tolerate this before they, start tuning out. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh, everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Oh, isn't there
anything?
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 Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, broadcasting right here on CITR. Just a reminder, if you are enjoying today's episode of The Sector, which is episode 45, why not subscribe to the podcast? You can do so at CITR.ca. Likewise, visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. You can download the podcast from our past episodes, as well as see all of our show notes that have links and important information about these episodes that you may find interesting. So check it out. As well as be sure to give me a follow on Twitter at Ethan Clow or at Sector Podcast, whatever you prefer. Anyway, getting over today's show. Now, I mentioned the potential for another great orange wave of NDP support across Canada. The first one saw the NDP propelled into the official opposition and the federal government. The second, of course, we saw the NDP sweep Alberta, something that has never, ever happened. So what will be the next one? Can we see a NDP government form in Canada? Would it be a minority government? Probably, but could it be also a majority? Well, that remains to be seen. Polls in the last couple of weeks have been kind of all over the place. We've seen some polls that show the NDP in a dead heat with the Liberals and Conservatives. Some polling has suggested that the NDP have surpassed the Liberals and are neck and neck with the Conservatives. And some have even pointed to the NDP pulling ahead. In fact, I was just looking at an article today in the paper suggesting that the NDP are set to unseat four key BC ridings that are currently held by the Conservatives. Now, what's interesting about these polls is that polls oftentimes are commissioned to simply give us a result, not because we're curious, but because we want to make people aware of who has a chance to win. This is to, I think, combat voting strategically, as well as to raise kind of like a general awareness. We want people to think, okay, well, our party is poised for a victory, so I should vote for them too, because then, you know, I'm voting for the winning party, whatnot. Polls notoriously, historically, often do get these things wrong. Just think back to BC's recent provincial election, which everybody predicted a major defeat for Christy Clark's Liberals, and instead they cruised to another majority government. Polls did not predict that. Polls predicted an NDP victory, and a strong one at that. Why did that happen? Well, there was lots of reasons. The sort of, what I've always suspected is that people tend to, despite what they publicly say and publicly do, they tend to vote down party lines. And if you voted for the Liberals, you know, two or three times, chances are you're likely to vote for them again, even if you don't really agree with their platform. You're probably going to go with the devil that you know, as opposed to the devil you don't. Now, can that happen for the federal government? Absolutely. It could totally happen. But there is also, I think, some argument to be made that the provincial election here was not a very good barometer in many ways, because the NDP here in BC didn't seem to get the vote out in the final tally. And this is something that, you know, we could underestimate. The requirement of motivating your base to get out there and vote is really important, obviously. But it's even more important to motivate them, especially if you think you're going to win. Because if too many people have the assumption that I don't need to vote because the party that I want to elect is going to get in regardless, that's a key to failure. A lot of people believe that that was one of the big problems with the BC election, was that because the NDP were heavily favored to win, a lot of their supporters didn't feel the need to vote. Now, again, I don't have the hard data in front of me, so that's just, you know, an assumption at this case. But it does point to the current polling, which are suggesting, you know, an NDP at least tie for first, and maybe even a bit better. The poll that I was looking at today was actually conducted by the Dogwood Initiative, which is a BC-based environmental nonprofit. Now, you might think, well, why would that be something that they're concerned about? Well, the organization has been looking at the environmental concerns of Canadians and those particular ridings. Things like oil tankers on the coast, climate change, government surveillance, energy usage, that sort of thing. By doing these polls, and, you know, again, when you have a left-wing organization like this, an environmental organization like this, doing a poll, it's not so much that there's a bias that's going to seep in, but it's as though, but basically what's going to happen is that they're going to almost self-select, and that is going to influence the information that they get. So I'm sure that if a conservative organization did the exact same poll, they may find a totally different result. But that being said, by publicizing the results of this poll, this organization helps rally support. They help make it more aware that supporters, people who are environmentally concerned in these ridings, they actually have a chance if they vote NDP. Now, all this being said, it is interesting to look at the news and a lot of the political commentary that's been going on, particularly around the concept of a, you know, federal NDP victory. There's been, interestingly enough, a lot of doubt thrown on the concept. People sort of, I think, pointing out or being skeptical of this notion of a third orange wave, even going so far as to kind of minimize the victory in Alberta and talk a bit about, you know, sort of the hopeful polling and whatnot. But again, like, I think it is interesting to just kind of consider this shift in terms of the NDP kind of becoming less of like a protest party and more of a legitimate third option. And one that's kind of unique in the sense that it appears to be capturing votes from both the Liberals and the Conservatives, as opposed to just kind of splitting the left. In fact, I mean, one of the interesting aspects of the Liberals shifting to the right in an effort to kind of, you know, be kind of the other centrist party, is that it's left more room for growth of the NDP on the other side. So it should be interesting to watch how this develops. We'll keep our eye on this. And again, I definitely want to get some more insight into where politically Canada is going to align in the next few months. So let's keep our eyes and ears focused on these topics. Anyway, let's take another quick commercial break here on The Sector. We'll be back with our nonprofit employee discussion coming up next.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. A picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days,
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeehaw!
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news, as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Hello, welcome back on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, discussing the world of nonprofits and social justice and activism, all those things. Anyway, right now we're talking a bit about what it's like to be an employee in the nonprofit world. More specifically, though, what are the individual characteristics that employees in the nonprofit world have? And also, what does one expect when working in a nonprofit environment? You know, what kind of skill set does this take? What can you expect in terms of money and what do you make? But ultimately, you know, what are the requirements? How do you prepare yourself both mentally, physically for the exhaustive and at times overwhelming world of the nonprofit sector? How can we understand this? Well, I mean, fortunately for you listeners, I happen to work in the nonprofit world, so I guess I'm uniquely qualified to help answer these questions. But for further information, I'm going to be basing this on things that I've learned. But also, you know, there are some articles out there that talk a bit about what it's like to work in the nonprofit sector, which I can link you to. And additionally, some of the information, some of the stats are things that I've acquired from previous references on, you know, doing this show. So whenever possible, I will try to direct you to some relevant information. But again, some of this may be off the cuff, so I do apologize if I don't have, you know, exact figures to back up what I'm saying. Let's start with the question of what kind of person takes on such a role in the nonprofit world. what motivates them, why do they do it, and what kind of persons do they usually tend to be? You know, I get asked this question quite a lot. You know, why do I want to work in the nonprofit world? What is my motivation? What draws me to these kind of roles? And in my experience, it's actually kind of a universal story. Most people do not enter the nonprofit sector as their first goal or their first job or their first vocation. It's usually people work in the for-profit industry in some sense. You know, they're working in marketing or communications or sales, some combination of those things. For whatever reason, the need to do social good takes hold, and they start looking at options in a different kind of environment. Once they find that environment in the nonprofit sector, usually they feel quite at home. Now, why is that? I mean, what makes it different? And I think a lot of people could, very uniquely sum up the feeling as, in the for-profit world, they're working for someone else. They're working for the man, so to speak. You know, they're helping make money for some organization, and it's a different kind of environment. You know, when you go to work and you finish your job, you go home, and that's it. You try to, de-stress from the workday. You don't take your work home with you. At least, you try not to. With the nonprofit world, though, you tend to do so, and, people kind of say, well, why would you enter an industry like that? Why would you even want to get involved in an organization where that is the case, where you get so emotionally invested? And I think the answer is that because people who want to work there, they just kind of naturally self-select. They kind of drift in because that's the kind of person they are. I think the people who want to work in the nonprofit world, they tend to be people who want to have something that is time-consuming, that is emotionally draining, because they are an emotional person. They have a streak of altruism in them, and they want to see their hard work go into an industry, go into a cause that they can feel a very strong emotional connection to. And again, that is not easy. It is definitely not easy to have to take your job home with you every night and feel like a lot is riding on you. And indeed, when you do take a job in the nonprofit sector, a lot does ride on you. I would definitely say that there is a strong connection for any position or any experience that relies on communication, particularly in terms of customer relations. In the nonprofit world, donations, fundraising, it's all tied into building relationships. So if you have strong communication skills, if communication is something that you're passionate about, then it's a natural fit to segue from that into the marketing or relationship building aspects of a nonprofit. The kind of classic example, of course, is sales. Now, what's interesting, of course, and we've actually talked to nonprofit fundraisers in the past about this sort of this connection from sales to fundraising. It's not always the quick, easy transition you would expect it to be. In a lot of cases, it's actually a lot more tricky. Sales is high pressure. And if you go into an industry where you're selling cars, for instance, you have a quota. You have to maintain a level of sales. You have to move product. In the nonprofit world, well, there still is that sense of you have to perform, you have to fundraise. You have to do so in a way that isn't high pressure. You can't be constantly nudging your donors to donate. You can't be that sort of pushy salesperson that in the for-profit world is basically rewarded. I mean, that's what commissions are all about. But when you transit to the nonprofit world, that kind of pushy sales is very kind of frowned upon. So it can be a very difficult transition if you're going from a high sales a job position where you're expected to move product to a nonprofit world where it's like, okay, well, you're expected to raise money and build funds, but not in a kind of high pressure, raise. It's meant to be considerably different. You're meant to be focused on relationship and rapport and this kind of trust building exercise. Now, does that mean that it's impossible? No. In fact, again, I think a lot of people do come from sales. They do bring a lot of experience from the sales industry into fundraising. And you do kind of see that in that kind of pushy fundraising, you know, people with a clipboard type job position. But, you know, for the really high end fundraising, people who raise millions upon millions of dollars, you'd be surprised that it's actually quite a leap from, you know, those two connections. And that's actually, you know, a good segue into the question of the skill set. Like, what body of experience do you find in a typical nonprofit employee? And this is a unique question because in the past, the skill set would have been any and everything. You know, kind of a jack of all trades in some sense. People who have experience in marketing and communications and sales, people who have experience in managing and leading people who have experience in design and content, and I guess you could kind of loosely term that kind of like artistic skill sets. But, you know, prior to maybe 5-10 years ago, there really wasn't like a training apparatus. You didn't get degrees or certificates in nonprofits. Whereas now, that is becoming increasingly more common. In fact, just recently I saw that SFU, Simon Fraser University, was offering nonprofit coursework. BCIT, here in BC, obviously, is offering coursework in the nonprofit sector, specifically taught by nonprofit employees. So that's a huge change. Prior to the development of actual nonprofit training material, originally it was just kind of a, like I said, a hodgepodge of experiences. But what specifically could you say is a skill set that a nonprofit employee might want to have? Or, you know, in a perfect world, what would be the skills that you'd want to have? Now, again, I mean, there's many positions in the nonprofit world that, you know, not directly related to fundraising. Human resources, administrative duties. If you've had a history with that, you know, there's lots of positions in the nonprofit world. And again, if you can transit your sense of I'm here to do a job and make money to I'm here to do social good, then that is a skill set that the nonprofit world wants. Interestingly enough, one thing that I found is that if you had any kind of work experience that was related to building a strong rapport, building a strong relationship, and whatever you want to call that, whether it is relationship building or communications, typically you might find that in something like a kind of like a corporate relations specialist, somebody who is establishing a strong rapport. That could be for the purpose of sales. So somebody who might be working with other organizations selling a relationship brand or helping to solidify a major sales or acquisitions. Those type of skill sets, that ability to establish a working relationship for the purpose of selling or establishing a brand is very popular in the nonprofit world. I mean, for not non-mysterious reasons, right? Like, if you're trying to convince somebody to give millions of dollars, having the background or the ability, really, to sit someone down and say, we're looking to establish a fund or a grant, and we want you to be a part of that. If your experience is, you know, selling a multi-million-dollar contract for a corporation, well, that's directly applicable skill set. I mean, that's something that the nonprofit world would just love to get their hands on because, again, you have that background of establishing trust, of establishing a business relationship that is not so much based on, as you know, FIFA might say, bribing people, but you have that experience of working with and establishing a business trust, a business-based, we are reliable, we are self-sustaining, we have a proven track record. This is why you should trust us with your millions of dollars. That is a skill set that the nonprofit world definitely relies on. Okay, so establishment so far. Nonprofit employees have an altruistic streak. They have a desire to do a social good, and possibly motivated by a bit of a burnout for just purely making money or making profit. They see a need and they want to help. Okay, established. Also established that nonprofit employees tend to have a bit of a diverse experience. They've done many things. They've had many trainings, not necessarily purely based on what it is they do right now. Because again, nonprofit training is relatively new in the world of, you know, education. They also have a skill set that is generally focused on things like communication, marketing, sales, or relationship building, a proven track record of doing these things for, you know, X amount of time. But let's talk about money, remuneration. What can the nonprofit employee expect back from their organization? Well, conventional wisdom has told us that the nonprofit world, you know, is not the most rewarding financially compared to the for-profit industry. This is ultimately unsurprising. Nonprofits have smaller budgets than a for-profit, obviously. They don't have the same kind of resources that a big corporation will have in terms of funding, in terms of shareholders, in terms of just raw profit. The nonprofit world, of course, is based on grants. It's based on private funding, government funding. All of these things come with stipulations that would not be there for a for-profit. So the amount of resources are smaller. That pool of money available to pay an employee is just a lot smaller. That being said, the average fundraiser, the average nonprofit employee is probably going to be looking at taking a fairly decent pay cut. Now, why, you might ask? Well, again, it goes back to that altruism streak. The idea that you're here to do a public service, you're here to do social good, and therefore you're going to get paid less for it. Now, this is starting to change in certain ways, of course. The classic example, of course, is if you go to like the CRA or any kind of charity watchdog website, you can look up what the top charity CEOs are making, and they're making decent money. I mean, more money than I think most people would expect them to be making. In some cases, millions of dollars. Very, very common to have, like, you know, top level fundraisers, top level CEOs making hundreds of thousands of dollars. This rankles some feathers. Some people think that this is greedy or selfish or somehow improper. We've actually talked about this in the past. You know, the idea that if you're doing good, social good, why shouldn't you be paid good money for it? We're very okay with and happy to see in some cases people who make soda pop, sugary soda pop that's sold to kids, violent video games or violent movies or whatnot, actors, professionals, people who are making millions upon millions of dollars. And again, not to throw shade at what it is they're doing, if they're doing it honestly, you know, whatever. But the fact that they're making all this money, we don't seem to bat an eyelash. And yet, the idea that you would make good money helping people seems to really bother us. And I think that that goes back to those sort of, you know, Puritan values of how the nonprofit world operates. Again, so the funny thing is, you go into the nonprofit world thinking, okay, I'm going to do social good. I'm going to be altruistic. I'm going to help people. And yet you get paid less. Why? Why would you do that? Why would you put yourself in that situation? Why would you allow that to happen? So not only, you know, are you paid statistically less than the for-profit industry, you're also subject to another big factor with the nonprofit world, and that is the stress and burnout related to doing your job. As I mentioned, when you work in the nonprofit world, you take your job home with you. You don't really have downtime hours. You may work in a more casual environment that's more progressive in a lot of ways, and perhaps you get more vacation time, perhaps you get better benefits and healthcare and all those things, which are great, and that kind of goes into the sort of counters the fact that you may get paid a degree less, but at least you're in an environment where if you wanted to take a slightly longer vacation, you could. This is also to counter the fact that there is a significant quality of stress with the nonprofit world. When I was working with CFI, for instance, I was in a state of almost constantly being on call. There was never really downtime. It was perfectly reasonable to find yourself working on a Saturday afternoon if the need came be. If you were getting media requests, it doesn't matter if it's Sunday or Saturday or what time of day it is. You have to follow up with it. If you have a meeting with a donor and they can only meet you Sunday night, that's when you're meeting them. So you're on the clock. All this means that you're going to be working unusual hours. You're going to be taking on a lot of stress. If you come home after a long day and you're thinking, okay, did we get the funding that we need to keep the lights on? That's pretty intense. You're going to be thinking about that all night, getting a little bit less sleep. And that sort of thing happens. I mean, I have seen the burnout that it can do to people. They come home, they take their job with them. They're at home sending messages to volunteers. They're taking phone calls all hours of the day. And that stress builds up. It builds up, it builds up. And you start to feel like the weight of the whole organization is dependent upon you getting that big donation, finishing off that big report, finishing off that research that the fundraisers need to, you know, take to their support base. And it, to a certain extent, you know, that stress is real because the organizations, the nonprofits of the world, as I said, they don't have that luxury of independently just producing wealth, producing finances. Everything that they get comes from grants, government grants, and the public, and the supporting public. So the fear of losing out or costing the organization resources, very much real. And the consequences of not managing that stress, of getting burnt out, can be devastating. People talk about taking like sick leave for things like the flu, or, you know, you fall down and you break your leg. But if you're suffering from burnout, I mean, you could just be sitting around unable to deal with stress. You could be feeling sick all the time, depressed. It has an impact on your mental health. It's one of the reasons why nonprofits tend to have a more robust medical support system for their employees, simply because if you're taking on that level of stress, if you're taking on that level of responsibility, it starts to weigh you down, and you need to find ways to let it out. And that's, again, why that you'll see, you know, an organization, even though you're not paid a lot, you might get a more generous vacation time. So what have we learned? In conclusion, what kind of person takes on the nonprofit role? Well, somebody who is altruistic, who wants to do social good, and is maybe tired of making money for, you know, the corporation, the man, whatever. What kind of skills do these people have? Well, a bit of everything. Sometimes they're jacks of all trade. Sometimes they have a unique experience that can be translated into doing social good, whether it's communications or fundraising or relationship building. Or they are willing to take their specialized skill set, HR, graphic design, whatever, and they feel that urge to do some good, so they transfer it over to the nonprofit world. And what can they expect to earn? Well, considerable less. Dan Pallotta had a pretty funny line in one of his TED Talks about the idea of, if you're skilled, if you have a great skill set for working in a nonprofit, it's actually probably better off for you in a lot of different ways to take a high-paying for-profit job, donate a huge sum of money to a nonprofit, get the public recognition as a philanthropist and a, you know, a good person, sit on the board of said nonprofit, and tell the sorry SOB who is running the organization what to do. You get paid more. You get all the benefit of helping out without the stress associated with it. Which, of course, leads to the next point, the danger of stress and burnout for the nonprofit world. It is a very demanding industry. It is very intensely personal. People invest so much of themselves in what they do that they really risk themselves mentally and physically in a lot of ways working for the nonprofit world. You know, not to make the suggestion that it's like dangerous, but it is a reality. So again, this is a bit of an overview of what working in the industry is like. And I think that if you're a part of the public, if you're a donor, keep it in mind and, you know, be sure to thank the people who you interact with when you donate. It really makes a difference for them. Anyway, we are really kind of running out of time here on today's episode of The Sector. Just a reminder, if you like today's show and you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can do so at citr.ca or sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, our website. You'll find our podcast, our show notes, any relevant data or information that we have about the episodes are all available there. We're also on Twitter, at Ethan Clow for me and at Sector Podcast for the show. And of course, we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Sector here on CITR, Fridays at 8 a.m. and, you know, via podcast whenever, wherever. So, my thanks for everyone tuning in and listening to episode 45 of The Sector. This is your host, Ethan Clow, saying thank you, have a great weekend, and we will see you all next week. Goodbye, everybody. Strength. I feel your faith in